This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Travel experts are calling this summer the worst in aviation history for passengers. Last month, another nightmare scenario. A flight sat on the tarmac for about 5 hours. Food and water ran low. Toilets backed up. Angry passengers banged overhead luggage bins and clapped in protest and were later placed under arrest. Grounded planes, massive delays, overbooked flights, electronic glitches, lack of information, lost luggage, bad weather. Over time, all this frustration has eroded both civility and goodwill. There's now widespread mistrust among passengers, clerks, flight attendants, pilots, and airline CEOs. Still, for the most part, we continue to buy tickets. And today, the Space Shuttle Endeavour returns safely to Florida. We'll talk about the gouge, the mission, and the future of the program, and your letters a little bit later in the program. But first, what's wrong with the airlines? Don't call us with horror stories. We know. We want questions about why it's so bad from passengers and from those of you who work in the industry. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email talk@npr.org, and you can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. And we begin with Dean Faust. He's the Atlanta Bureau Chief for Business Week, and he joins us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Nice to have you on the program today.
Happy to be here.
So whatever happened to the friendly skies?
You know, I joke to my friends that air travel these days has about as much romance as taking a Greyhound bus cross-country.
I ride Greyhound buses, and they've still got a long way to go down to that. But go ahead.
Well, you and I can both think back to 20 years ago when there was a certain romance. Go back to the 1950s, and you can, hear the lore of planes having bars and pianos and nothing like that. And it is as bad as it's not just your imagination. In the month of June, it was the worst month ever. 30% of all flights were at least an hour or more late.
And this seems to be people seem to come into the airport angry.
They do. And I think they're they do come in angry, and you know, you go to YouTube, and it seems like every couple of weeks there's a new video posted by someone who was trapped on one of those planes on the tarmac for an hour or two or three. There's a video now that's gotten hundreds of thousands of views of a Delta plane that sat on the tarmac. There are changes, there are reforms, there are ways to improve the situation. But there are no easy fixes, and it's going to take a lot of pain, and it's going to take a lot of time.
There are some things that do work. Those self-service check-in kiosks, for example, those work great. At the same time, they've greatly reduced the number of staff.
They do, and if you need to make changes to your flight or if you do have a problem, the line is there's only one person to help, and that line is always the longest line. Mm. That's helped. I think some of the other features that airlines have introduced, such as sending alerts to your cell phone or your mobile device, your BlackBerry, if your flight is delayed by 30 minutes, an hour, I think does help prevent you from being stuck in an airport. But I think there's a lot more that airlines can do that they don't want to do. One suggestion I have is that the airline should be required to post the on-time records for every flight on the websites and the travel sites when you're booking your ticket. I think you have a right to know that 5:30 flight from JFK to Atlanta is on time only 40% of the time.
Mm-hmm. Well,
airlines don't want to do that.
Yeah. Why do airlines overbook, and why does the system allow them to schedule more flights than apparently the system can handle?
Simple reason. Airlines are desperate for revenue, and they're desperate for profits. You have to remember that this airline, if you go back to the first flight by the Wright brothers and took all the profits that the airlines made over the next 50, 60, 70 years, and then you add in what the airlines lost since the year 2000, this is an industry that has collectively lost money. Warren Buffett famously said that someone would have done investors a favor if if someone has shot down the Wright brothers on that first flight at Kitty Hawk. They're you know, look, all the major, you know, most of the major carriers were in bankruptcy only a few years ago. They're desperate. They overbook. Depends by flight, depends by time of day, but it isn't unusual on a busy route to see an airline overbook habitually by 3, 4, 5%. And the reason they do it is because right now the penalties for overbooking, if they do bump you, are fairly modest, just a couple of hundred dollars. And if they can bump you and add on a late-paying business traveler who's willing to pay $800, $900 for that same seat, it's a business decision they're willing to make.
Mm-hmm. And the system of you know, just simply I guess you answered that. It's a look for profits, and you're right. A lot of these companies were in serious trouble not so very long ago. Some of the problem, though, is technological. For example, the air traffic control system.
I think there, yes, indeed. Right now, the air industry is working off of a 1950s Ozzie and Harriet generation radar system that worked in that era. But you know, last year the industry flew 750 million passengers, and the problem is that radar. There are 22 different centers around the country that the FAA mans with air traffic controllers who are following radar. And so what that means is that airlines can't fly point to point. They can't randomly fly them what they think is the most efficient route. They have to fly within these certain lanes. Imagine an interstate highway system in the skies, and they have to fly on those mandated highways because they have to fly within a certain range of each of those, one of those 22 air traffic control centers. And, you know, that's very inefficient in this day and age. The solution is to move to a satellite-based system, a GPS system, where you could have the planes monitored by satellite. Right now, because this radar system is very inefficient, I mean, it can take as long as 22 seconds for one air traffic controller to hand off a plane to the next controller. So they're very conservative. They space out planes generally about at least 5 miles apart. With a GPS system, you could fly planes much closer. You could land them closer with less spacing. And as a result, you could get a lot more planes up in the air and you could land them quicker.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we get some callers in on this conversation. I don't think it's going to be hard. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. Let's start with Nathan, who's calling from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Hello there.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a question. I've seen a lot of the problem as disenfranchised employees in the industry, you know, from baggage handlers to people at the counter just very unwilling to help. Have there been case studies on specifically, you know, Southwest Airlines? Those guys are still making a profit. And I mean, they used to sing to us. And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks very much. What do you think, Dean Faust?
There's a reason that the airline employees are surly. They have seen their pay cut dramatically in the past 7, 8 years. You know, once upon a time, airline pilots made as much as $300,000 or even $400,000 if they were flying very, very lucrative international routes on the next generation planes. Most of the major carriers, with the exception really of American and among the discounters, Southwest, were all in bankruptcy. And as part of that, the management teams asked the employees to take pay cuts of as much as 25, 30, 40%. That's one thing if you're an airline pilot seeing your pay cut from $400,000 to $230,000. It's another thing if you're a stewardess seeing your pay cut from $30,000 to $22,000. Some of these employees in the airline industry are now making not too much more than minimum wage, what they could make working at a fast food restaurant.
Well, joining us now is David Field. He's America's editor for Airline Business Magazine. He joins us on the line from Cape May in New Jersey. Nice to have you on the program today.
My pleasure.
And is it only anger over wages, why employees are angry at their airlines?
Oh, no, it's far more than anger over wages, and I'd say it's far more complex than anger. pilots, flight attendants, everyone else at the airlines that have been through reorganization have seen not just the take-home pay cut, but the pensions cut or canceled and turned over to the federal government. the same time, they're working longer hours for considerably less pay. And as Dean said, it's not just the pilots who probably can afford it, but it's flight attendants, it's baggage tossers, it's the nice harassed lady behind the counter. And yeah, some of these folks are now making $18,000, $19,000 a year, and there's no pension. And it creates a culture of embitterment, particularly if you're going to be dealing with angry people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you work for United Airlines, which was in bankruptcy for almost 3 years, and you took a 30% pay cut, and you're working 10% more hours, and you got no pension. And when you go to the airport in the morning, the first thing that happens is an angry customer who doesn't trust you because the customer knows that the flights are usually late. He's seen all the stories and listened to radio shows like this. Customer comes in. He's suspicious. He wants to fight with you. The people on the airplane are angry and want to fight with you, and you're not making any money. Sure, it's more than anger. It's a deep bitterness, and I think it's going to take years for that kind of bitterness and mistrust to go away.
Hmm. Is management trying to do things to help their employees cope with this situation?
Not really. There are a few steps here and there, employee involvement teams and so on. Northwest Airlines, which has had some of the most troubled labor relations, is actually trying to do things about it by getting employees more involved in scheduling and so on. But by and large, right now, the airlines are just trying to get through this summer from hell. And maybe when things slow down in the autumn, they'll have the time to catch their breath and think about doing something.
Right. And only making matters worse is the management teams of some of these airlines have been enriching themselves with bonuses for bringing an airline out of bankruptcy. The executive teams are helping them navigate the industry storm. The executive teams at Northwest and American recently rewarded themselves with very large bonuses, and that only set off the workers at those the pilots at those airlines even more.
Yeah, Northwest and American gave themselves bonuses. They weren't that extreme. The one place I think you're justified in pointing a finger is at United,
mm-hmm.
where Glenn Tilton, the former oil company executive, is getting double-digit millions for having taken the airline through bankruptcy.
David Field and Dean Faust are our guests. We're talking about the summer from hell for airline passengers. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We've heard all the horror stories this summer, multiple delays at the airport, planes stuck on the tarmac for hours, no drinks or toilets. There's now a coalition for a passenger's bill of rights. They want Congress to put a stop to the long delays, and they've invited legislators to what they're calling a strand-in, a simulation of what it's like to be stuck on a grounded plane for hours. You can find out more about what's behind the record number of flight delays this summer at our website, npr.org. Our guests are Dean Faust, Atlanta Bureau Chief for Business Week Magazine, and David Field. He's America's editor for Airline Business Magazine. And we want your questions, not more horror stories. We know about those. But if you're a passenger or work in the industry, why? Why is it so bad this summer? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And let's turn to Scott. Scott's with us from St. Louis in Missouri.
Good afternoon, Neil. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Neil, I'm a general aviation pilot. I don't work in the industry, but I have the great honor and pleasure of flying in the system. And I'm continually impressed with the professionalism of the air traffic controllers and the commercial pilots. You know, I think one of the big misconceptions about the system is that, you know, the GPS is not in wide use. It is in use. It, you know, as a general aviation pilot, I use GPS every day. And, you know, it is available. It is used. You know, I think the biggest problem is the hub model that the airlines are using. They're, you know, trying to get too many flights into too few airports, you know, all at the same time. And inevitably that ends up creating delays, creating problems. You know, you've got a situation where, you know, airlines are, you know, sitting at the gate and they've got to pull out and get in line so that they can get their place in the system. And when there's that many planes sitting on the tarmac, you're going to inevitably have delays. And until the airlines come up with a better way to schedule airline traffic, you're going to have these kind of problems. I think a related problem is, we don't have enough airports, not enough big commercial airports. I think I saw a statistic not too long ago that said we haven't built a new airport in the United States in the last 20 years. I think only two new airports in the last 20 years. I think one is one was DFW and the other one's out in Denver.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a big problem.
Well, they keep adding on to airports. It's been my contention that no airport was ever finished. They always keep working on it. But anyway, David Field, does Scott have a point?
John has a very good point. GPS is in use, but what we're talking about is far more than the GPS that you have on GA. It's a much more advanced, much more complex system, as Dean Faust was pointing out earlier. But, yeah, the hub airports are very much part of the problem. And I think it's really going to be a little bit unrealistic to expect the airlines to move away from the hub-and-spoke model. I think one of the issues is going to be forcing airlines to moderate their use of certain overused airports. And I mainly mean by this the airports in the New York City area, and specifically LaGuardia. New York City airports are the worst in the nation for delays. Their delays ripple up and down the coast from Boston to Florida, from the Atlantic Ocean all the way to the Mississippi. They are one of the reasons why we're slowing down, and one of the reasons why we're slowing down is LaGuardia has routinely, chronically, 3 and 4 hour runway delays because it is overscheduled, because the FAA has failed to regulate traffic there, has failed to ration traffic there. Politically, that's going to be very hard to do given the political power of the airlines and the desires of the traveling public. But as our guest suggests, I think we're going to have to look at that.
Thanks very much for the call, Scott. Go ahead.
Dean Faust. I was just going to make the point that David is right. I mean, the hub and spoke system isn't perfect, but to borrow a phrase that Alan Greenspan used to love to it's the least worst system. I think without the hub and spoke, you would lose a lot of service to second and third tier cities like Chattanooga, Tennessee, or Huntsville, Alabama. I think one of the real problems we're seeing right now is that in the past 5-6 years, as the airlines have tried to get their footing again, they have actually stopped using as many big jets, and they've shifted more travel to smaller regional jets that may seat anywhere from 37 to 80 passengers. David talked about JFK and the New York airports. At JFK, the average flight coming in and taking off and landing at JFK only has about 80 seats, 90 seats. And JFK officials have gone to the airlines and said, talked about creating a minimum size requirement, mm-hmm. 100 to 120 seats. But the truth is the airlines don't want to do that because it's cheaper for them to fly the regional jets. And passengers don't want that as well because we love smaller planes mean more frequency. So you can fly every hour. And also, if you're in a small market, those regional jets are what makes it cost effective for the airlines to fly into places like Binghamton and Syracuse.
Here's an email question from Douglas. What about international airlines not based in the United States, such as Lufthansa and Qantas? Are they in better shape than the U.S. airlines? David Field?
Yes, very much so, in part because they weren't hit as hard by 9-1-1, which was obviously an attack on the U.S., and they weren't hit as hard by the dot-com collapse, which was really the beginning of the airline horror story in the U.S., the spring of 2000. They went through their own restructurings, in some cases with the aid of the European community, but they've largely been privatized. They've dealt with labor, and, yeah, they're making money. They're way ahead of us. As a matter of fact, a lot of these airlines are going into the down cycle just as we're at the top of, the up cycle.
Mm-hmm. David Field, thanks very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
David Field, America's editor for Airline Business Magazine. He joined us on the line from Cape May in New Jersey. And with us now here in Studio 3A is James C. May. He's president and chief executive officer of the Air Transport Association, based here in Washington, D.C. Kind of you to join us today.
Thank you, Neil.
And obviously it's been a difficult summer for a lot of airlines, and a lot of passengers are upset. And is this chronic? Is this going to be solved?
It has been a tough summer, and it's going to get worse. It started a number of years ago, and as traffic in the system continues to increase, You mentioned it, one of your guests mentioned it a few minutes ago. Mm-hmm. We're trying to deal with that additional traffic using 1950s technology. A couple of quick points. The FAA is moving today about 45,000 flights per day around the United States. That's all what we'll call IFR mm-hmm. traffic. That's gonna jump to 62,000 flights a day inside of 8 years. We're going to go from 750 million passengers to a billion passengers. And we've got two choices. We can either create an air traffic control system that can handle that kind of capacity, or it's going to continue to slow down. It will be like pouring glue into the system.
Mm-hmm.
Civil aviation, commercial aviation, is in fact a big part of the economic backbone of this country. And whether it's cargo or passenger, and the only way we're going to have a real solution, you've talked about a lot of the results of those delays.
Mm-hmm.
Passengers upset, mishandled bags, employees who are disgruntled and aren't as friendly as a lot of passengers would like them to be, all of which is perfectly understandable. But at the end of the day, if we don't address the root cause and put the multi-billions of dollars that are necessary into a new air traffic control system, it's going to continue.
Hmm.
And we have to recognize that this is a national priority. It is just as we have to worry about the ground infrastructure that was heightened as a result of the bridge collapse in Minneapolis.
Yeah.
We have to recognize that if we're going to maintain the safety record that we've got today, which is first and foremost our goal, and it's perfect right now, that we're going to have to put the dollars in to get the job done.
Yet, in the meantime, and there's no, even if Congress decided to vote that money tomorrow, it would be quite some time before that system could be installed. In the meantime, airlines take the brunt of this. There's been a loss of trust. There's been an erosion of goodwill, and too often, as we've seen, an erosion of civility. People are screaming at each other.
That is exactly right, and believe me, in my position, I hear those screams on a regular basis. And look, there's an economic impact here. We're losing $8 to $10 billion a year because of delays. There is no industry that wants to solve the delay problem more urgently than airlines do. And by the way, there are a lot of things that can be done very short term. We heard that New York is the most congested airspace in the nation right now. That's absolutely true.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of operational directions that can be taken that will solve a lot of the problems in New York. Kennedy has four runways. We only use two at a time. Now, that's not the case in almost any other major airport in the country today. But traditionally, we've only used two. Newark, same situation. There are three runways. We're only using two. It's a lot more difficult and a lot tougher to use more intersecting runways, but it can be done, and it can increase the capacity of those airports. The next thing that can happen is airspace redesign in New York.
Hmm.
That's been held up by the politicians for years, and yet everybody acknowledges we need to have airspace redesign because there are some 25 different airports in the New York metropolitan Connecticut area that are feeding into that system. We need to make some very fundamental changes to the way we do business. And I think it has to be done on a very cooperative basis with the air traffic controllers, with commercial, with private, and others to get the job done.
Let me turn to Dean Faust of Business Week. We're hearing James May say, look, a lot of these problems are based on the government, basically.
I think he's got a point, and there are some experts who believe that we should move to – that the FAA is not up to the task. We're talking about the GPS system, which is called Next Gen. This is not the first time the FAA has taken a stab at modernizing the radar-based system. They tried back in the 80s, and it didn't work. You know, there are other countries like Canada and Australia and Switzerland that have basically created a private, for-profit organization to effectively do the task that the FAA is doing now, arguing that a private organization can do a better job. They make the analogy to the stock exchanges. What would the stock exchanges in the U.S. be like if they were run by the federal government? and that a private organization could do the job better. But the question I have is, however, is the political will to really tackle some of these issues? Talk about we're not using runways efficiently, we're not managing the airspace in that New York to Philadelphia and Washington corridor. You know, my sense is that there's a lot of public outcry about some of these changes, because when at JFK, when you start rerouting how flights come in and land and where they fly, you're getting a lot of community opposition from people who suddenly, you know, hear plane noise all day long.
I used to live in Queens, and you could count the rivets on some of those planes coming into the
corridor. Another example is L.A. I mean, L.A. International badly needs more runways, but the people in the surrounding areas don't want it. And, you know, the recent election, all the mayoral candidates said, I do not support adding runways to L.A. International.
And that is fundamentally the problem that we've got, is that everybody recognizes the importance, but it's a NIMBY, not in my backyard, syndrome.
James May of the Air Transport Association and Dean Faust of Business Week. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. Anthony. Anthony with us from Boston.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Good. I have a very simple question. As it stands today, what are passengers' rights? What rights do we have if we get stuck on a plane like that?
James May, do passengers have any rights when they're stuck on a plane for hours on the tarmac?
I think they absolutely do. And I think that all of our carriers have reinvested in what we call the customer service commitments. They are listed on the websites of the individual carriers. They have been filed with the Inspector General's Office of the Department of Transportation within the last month or so. We have asked the IG to do an investigation into those customer service commitments and see if they need further updating. They've been updated. Mm-hmm. So that we don't have the unfortunate circumstances of keeping people inordinately long times on airplanes, sitting on the tarmac. And, mm-hmm. and let me make a final point here, because I think for the gentleman. Nobody wants to complete those flights more than we do. We've got crews that are going to time out. We've got angry passengers. We want to get those flights completed, and for the most part, so do our customers, because they recognize in an increasingly crowded environment that getting rebooked on another plane.
Hold on, Anthony.
Okay.
That getting rebooked on another plane is increasingly more difficult.
All right, Anthony, go ahead.
That's too general of an answer. I'm asking you to put yourself in now a passenger stuck on a tarmac. What does he or she do?
What can they do when they're stuck in the tarmac?
What do they do right there and then?
I think the answer is the same thing I do when I'm stuck on a tarmac.
Without getting arrested, that is.
is try and be as patient as possible. And I think requesting information as to what the status is perfectly appropriate. If we have a failing that we need to correct more aggressively, it is that we don't give our passengers as much information on as timely a basis. But on the other side of that equation, we often don't know, because it's the FAA that are controlling the environment, and we can only tell our passengers what the FAA are telling us.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call, Anthony. Information is, and let me turn to Dean Faust on this. It is the most frustrating thing to be waiting on a plane or at a, you know, holding area at an airport and feeling that the airline must know and they're just not telling you, or they're not telling you the truth.
I agree that information better information could go a long way to making passengers feel better. As I mentioned earlier, I think that airlines should be required on the ticketing sites, reservation sites, to report the on-time record of each and every flight. I do think airlines need to do a better job of providing passengers with an update. They need to do a better job of giving higher, more money in refunds or payments for passengers that are bumped. One reform that's gotten a lot of attention is that after a certain number of hours, be it 2 hours or 3 hours on a tarmac, that the pilot should be required by law to turn back to the gate to give passengers a chance to get off. I'd be interested in Mr. May's opinion on that. I can go both ways. I can appreciate where it's coming from, but I hear the criticism that could make pilots feel pressured to get that plane in the air, even if it isn't the best decision from a safety perspective.
We're going to have to wait for that answer because we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to continue talking about the difficulties of the airlines and the difficulties so many passengers have faced this summer. Our guests, Dean Faust of Business Week and David Field, who's the, and James May, who's the Chief Executive Officer of the Air Transport Association. We'll also be talking about the safe landing today in Florida of the Space Shuttle Endeavor. So stay with us. I'm Neil Cohn, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we're continuing our conversation on the nightmarish summer for many airline passengers. Our guests are Dean Faust, who's the Atlanta Bureau Chief for Business Week, James May, the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Air Transport Association. And James May, just before the break, Dean Faust asked, should there be a cap, 2 hours on the tarmac, the pilot must return to the airport terminal?
Short answer, no, there shouldn't be a cap. The decision should be left in the hands of the FAA, the pilot in command. I think the real catch-22 that most passengers find themselves in is that they want to complete their flight. So does the airline. We need that plane at the next destination. We've got another load of passengers, so on and so forth. If we turn around and go back, we're going to lose our place in line. We're likely to have pilots or crews time out, is the industry term, run out of legal time to fly. And it could be just within moments that we get clearance to go. I was on a flight the other day going from Washington to LaGuardia in New York. I sat on the tarmac for 2 hours, and at about 2:10, 2:20, we finally got clearance because there was a thunderstorm sitting right on the top of LaGuardia. Now, the real issue was making sure that we had information, we knew what was going on. The pilots did a terrific job of keeping us posted to the extent that the FAA would tell them what was going on. But it was weather-related, as the vast majority of the delays are. And, what we would prefer to do is say, all right, at a certain level, and I think all of our carriers have put processes in place, let's begin to assess when we're going to turn this flight around and when we're going to make a final go, no-go decision. Recognizing that it's weather most of the time. Is it going to clear? The American Airlines incident in December of this year was a series of what were called chaining thunderstorms that all happened to go right through DFW. So just about Dallas-Fort Worth, just about the time they thought they'd get clearance, another storm would come through. Mm-hmm. So I think at the end of the day, most of our passengers, based on our own surveys, would prefer that we keep them informed, let them know what's going on. When it gets to be unreasonable, 3 hours plus, then begin to bring those planes back into the terminal area. But recognize that when we do that, it almost always will result in some form of cancellation, and then rebooking those passengers can be far worse than an additional 20 or half hour delay in the process. On denied boarding, just a quick note. The DOT...
You mean bumped passengers?
Bumped passengers.
From overbooking?
From any of a number of reasons.
Uh-huh.
Could have more connecting passengers coming in. There's a number of reasons it can happen. But the DOT has begun a proceeding on compensation for denied boarding, and that is underway right now. We'll know the results of that sometime in the near future. But the real numbers just released by the DOT are that there's about 1.33 passengers per 10,000 passengers that actually get denied boarding.
Yeah, each one of them, however, is really mad.
Oh, anyway, absolutely.
Let's get
each have a blog.
Yeah, that's true. Let's get a caller on the line. Let's go to, this is Mike, and Mike is with us on the line from Chicago. He's been very patient.
Hey, thanks, Neil. This is Mike Donatelli. I'm Captain Mike Donatelli. Jim May, I have a question for you. I'm an airline pilot, and I'm chairman of the Strategic Preparedness and Strike Committee for the Airline Pilots Association International. I really appreciate David Fields and Dean Faust's candor. I've seen management take this industry from gray to greyhound, and they used the exact term today, and I was really happy to hear that. Now our level of service is deplorable. Our employees are understaffed, overworked, and unhappy. And why wouldn't they? Most of us, including myself, have had a 50% pay cut. We've lost our pensions, while management's received obscene bonuses approved by the bankruptcy courts. The employees gave to keep these companies in business, and we can't even be proud of the service we provide. So, Jim, I ask you, what are the industry-specific plans to improve service to the level that customers will pay an amount that allows the industry to become safely profitable? And how exactly are employees to be rewarded equal to their sacrifices? And finally, Jim, have you ever stopped to consider that if airline managements treated their workers like other new economy companies, then maybe we wouldn't need a strike committee after all? Frankly, I think the pilots have said enough is enough.
Okay, Mike, let's get a response from James May.
As Mike knows, I can't give a specific answer to a lot of those questions. I think that based on my conversations with our CEOs, they all recognize that they've got real work to do to reestablish, reconnect with their employee base. I think all of them are doing that and engaging in efforts. I've seen them questioned on, you know, Doug Steenland just the other day on the Today Show, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And we understand there's a real issue. The bad news is that there have been a lot of cuts. The bad news is that, you know, a lot of people have had to make sacrifice. The good news is that those carriers emerged from bankruptcy. They did so in a much healthier fashion than they were there before. So a lot of jobs were saved in that process. And I think there has to be a balance of recognition for that as well.
What about his point, though, of maybe what could airlines do to improve services to the point where people would be willing to pay a little bit more and increase profits so people could start making better money?
Believe me, there is no motivation like the profit motivation for carriers or any other business in America. And I'm confident that all of the individual carriers have plans to try and increase their profitability and their relationships with their workers across the board.
Mike, I'm not sure you're going to be happy with those answers, but that's what we've got for you.
No, Neil, but at least we got the point out there that the employees are the ones that sacrifice for these companies, and the employees should be rewarded when the companies turn into profits, not the CEOs. There's only a few individuals right now that are profiting, and the CEOs need to wake up and understand that in a service industry, the employees that deal with the customers on a daily basis and the pilots that fly those airplanes need to be treated with respect and dignity.
And so do the passengers, Mike. So do the passengers. Thanks very much. Let's see if we get one last caller in, and this is going to be Melinda. Melinda's with us from Fort Lauderdale.
Hi. I'm also a captain for a major carrier, and the two comments I really had was, you know, when we do inform our passengers, but if you go back to the gate, a lot of times the FAA, you lose your slot for takeoff. So even though you after 3 hours, you go back to the gate, you may have to wait another 6 or 7 hours before your takeoff opportunity. And you have these passengers who are demanding, you know, champagne service, but they're paying the same, if not less, than they were 25 years ago for the same seat on the airplane.
I hear your point, but really, champagne service, it's Diet Coke at best.
Not even, but, you know, you pay $40 for a Fort Lauderdale to New York ticket, and you expect to be treated a first-class, you know, service, you know, the fares do have to come up with the salaries and the benefits for the employees if that's the service you want.
Yeah, I think a point we should make here is that we spent the time beating up on airlines and beating up on airline management, and I think passengers and consumers, we bear a little bit of the blame here. As the cartoon character Pogo said, we've met the enemy, and he is us. Look, as passengers, we don't want to pay more than $200 for a flight. That puts pressure on the airlines to jam as many people in, to overbook, et cetera, to fly smaller, cheaper planes. And at the same time, we only want to fly in certain parts of the day. You know, people talk about creating congestion pricing so that flights that take off during prime time hours, say 5:30 to 8:30 p.m., passengers would be required to pay more, and thus it would create an incentive for to spread out the flights more evenly through the day and address this congestion. But I'm a business traveler. I like to fly at 7:30 or 8 because I can put in a full work day. If I fly in the morning, I want to fly at 7:30 or 8 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to fly at 1 p.m. And you know, most passengers take the same approach, that if Delta can't give us that 7:30 flight here in Atlanta, I'll look at AirTran or I'll look at a connecting flight.
All right. Melinda, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And we're going to thank our guests. You just heard from Dean Faust, Atlanta Bureau Chief for Business Week. He joined us today from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Thanks for your time.
Well, thank you.
And we also had in Studio 3A here in Washington, James May, President and Chief Executive Officer of the Air Transport Association. Appreciate you coming in.
Thanks very much.
And we'll be talking about the Endeavour's flight home in just a moment.